Okay. So the time now is 8:30 a.m. on September 18th, and I call the meeting of the Complaints Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, would you please call the roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Mr. Wen?
Present.
We have quorum and may proceed.
On July 17th, 2024, the Complaint Screening Committee regular session and executive session minutes. So would any member like to make a motion to approve the minutes of those meetings?
So moved.
Second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Okay. The motion carries. Before discussing the cases scheduled for review today, I will be sharing important information for everyone in attendance. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to Arizona Revised Statutes 32-2081H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed as a response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-2081H1. Upon a vote of a majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38-431.0382 to review confidential records or subsection A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Jean Gavin. Please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda upon the parties being present. Please use initial only for patients, children, and the complainant. In addition, do not state specific diagnoses in open session. Instead, please state the diagnosis on record. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential, and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. A person or a representative of a person who has filed a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement to the committee up to 5 minutes, only when prompted by the chair. Additionally, the licensee or respondent who is the subject of the complaint will also have an opportunity to make a brief 5-minute statement only when prompted by the chair. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or respondent after their statement is made. Please note that only individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant and respondent, may address the committee and make statements. If the committee wishes to hear from any other party, it will make this request during the case review. For everyone in attendance today, please ensure that your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, respondent, and their legal representative may unmute themselves at that time. Please note that individuals in attendance who speak without committee approval will be warned twice by the chair not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter the meeting. So the first complaint scheduled for review is case number 24-36 against Danielle Powers. Dr. Stewart, would you please provide a brief overview of this complaint since you are the lead? You are muted, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you. The complaint against Dr. Danielle Powers, PsyD. Dr. Powers obtained her doctorate from the Arizona Professional School of Psychology in 2014 and was first licensed in the state of Arizona on 10-14 of 2014. The overview of the complaint is that the complainant, DB, was in the Federal Bureau of Prisons and that Dr. Powers, there was an incident in September, end of September, September 30th, 2023, in which Dr. Powers was conducting what's called cell checks. And the allegation is that she threatened to assault DB twice and made inappropriate comments related to race and his physical disability in violation of ethical principles and the Bureau of Prisons policies. DB also filed federal civil rights lawsuits against the United States and several Bureau of Prisons employees, including Dr. Powers, regarding various allegations of medical negligence. The lawsuit states that some of the issues raised in the board complaint are in addition to the allegations involving other clinicians. The complaint alleges that Dr. Powers and apparently a group of psychologists, including Dr. Townsend, were present during a cell check where Dr. Powers was acting as a deputy warden and not as a psychologist. When the complaint took place, the DB indicates that this matter was witnessed by other Bureau of Prison employees who in turn reported Dr. Powers to their Office of Internal Affairs. The licensee's response, Dr. Powers submitted a 4-page response in a timely manner and denied the allegations categorically. Dr. Powers states that on the morning of the alleged incidents, DV saw medical staff. The medical note associated with that appointment contains an admission by the medical doctor that his previous, apparently, note, there's a misprint or something left out, about DV's neurological condition mistakenly misinterpreted the findings of a neurologist. Dr. Powers goes on to say that had she made such a comment, that any other Bureau of Prison employee would be required to report it. Dr. Powers also states that Dr. Townsend told Dr. Powers' attorney that she did not recall witnessing any such complaint event, and that she does not recall any such conversation with DV or Dr. Powers. Dr. Powers goes on to state that Agent Alvarez will testify if needed that DV told him there were no other people who could confirm his story, not even Dr. Townsend. Dr. Powers also states that Agent Alvarez indicated that since there were no other witnesses, no investigation was open. And that's the extent of the review. I do have a note dated August 1st, 2024, from the U.S. Department of Justice, Associate Attorney General, to the Board of Examiners, stating that an investigation was not conducted because there was no one to substantiate the allegations. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Is complainant DB or his power of attorney present? If so, please unmute yourself and state your initials only for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Yes, I'm here. I am SB, and I'm appearing on behalf of my husband, DB. As a legal professional, I felt it was important to appear today to ask that you hold Dr. Powers responsible for her actions. For a psychologist who was very well aware of her patient's mental health vulnerabilities, to knowingly threaten to assault and batter him was not only unprofessional, but illegal. For a licensed mental health professional to take reckless action, which caused further real-life mental illness to my husband, as diagnosed by Dr. Powers' own colleagues, goes against the very core of a psychologist's purpose. My husband was entrusted under Dr. Powers' care to receive mental health treatment from psychologists under her supervision. Instead, due to Dr. Powers' actions, he has now been diagnosed with yet another mental health illness as a direct result of her actions. My husband now requires additional mental health prescriptions and care. For this, I ask that you hold Dr. Powers accountable. For a chief psychologist to threaten to cause physical harm to a patient, which was the very trauma that caused his initial mental health diagnosis, and then to go on and belittle his disability was extreme and outrageous. My husband was diagnosed as wheelchair-bound by a licensed neurologist that Dr. Powers' employer hired to evaluate and diagnose him. For Dr. Powers to physically threaten him, belittle his disability, and say that he's faking it and doesn't need a wheelchair should not be the conduct that the Board of Psychologist Examiners should tolerate. This type of behavior should not represent what the board constitutes as acceptable behavior. I ask that you weigh not only Dr. Powers' actions, but also the consequences of her actions, which has resulted in real-life damages. Thank you for your time.
Good morning.
SB. Committee members, are there any questions for DB's Power of Attorney, SB? Okay. Thank you for being here, SB. Hearing none, Dr. Powers, are you and your attorney present?
Yes, good morning. I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney BH. Okay. And I did want to add that there was one further development that happened since the answer, and that is that the inmate's lawsuit was finally dismissed and not refiled.
Okay, give me 1 second. Let me make an announcement, and then you will have an opportunity to speak. So if you may unmute both yourselves and state your full names for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statements.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. Assistant U.S. Attorney Brock Heathcott, in addition to what I just said, Dr. Powers would like to make a brief statement.
Good morning, Dr. Powers here. I just want the board to hear from me that at no time did I threaten, belittle, or any of the other allegations made against me by DB. At no time did those events occur. That's all.
Okay. Thank you.
We don't have anything further at the moment unless there are any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Committee members, are there any questions for Dr. Powers or her attorney? Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Chair. A question for Mr. Heathcott. Do we have documentation that the lawsuit was either dismissed or dropped?
I did forward the dismissal to Ms. Michelson, so okay. Your office should have it, yes.
Okay, and as I recall, that was it was dropped on the court's own motion, the sua sponte motion from the court.
Correct. It was dismissed pursuant to the court's protocol on screening inmate lawsuits.
Okay, thank you very much. I have no further questions.
And if I may, Dr. Stewart and committee members, the court's decision is on page 119 of your file.
Oh, thank you.
This is a document that Mr. Heathcott was referencing that was sent to staff.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Are there any other questions for Dr. Powers or her attorney? Okay. Well, hearing none, the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. Dr. Stewart, would you please begin the deliberation since you are the lead?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I think that in light of the dropping or the dismissal by the court's own action of the lawsuit, I don't know that we can go forward at this point. So it sounds like a case of he said, she said. The complainant indicated that there were witnesses, and the response is that the supposed the named witnesses indicated that they did not hear any such conversation or actions being taken by Dr. Powers against the complainant.
Thank you. I agree with what you just shared, Dr. Stewart. Unfortunately, there is nothing really to substantiate the allegations, and no one really stepped up saying, I witnessed that it happened. So it's really difficult for us to really move forward with this complaint.
I think Jeannie Hens wants to weigh in on this.
Yeah, good morning. Just one comment so we are sure that the record is clear. Dr. Stewart, the fact that the court dismissed the lawsuit is a factor that you can consider, but that doesn't deprive the board from moving forward. I think after your statement about the court's dismissal of the case, you did articulate that there was no substantiation, there's no evidence to support the allegation, but I just want to be sure that everyone understands that while you can consider the dismissal, the fact that they did dismiss does not mean that we can't adjudicate the case.
Thank you, Ms. Gavin. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yes. In light of there not that the an investigation by Agent Alvarez not turning up any credible witnesses to support the allegations, I move that the case be dismissed.
Okay. Is there a second? I'll second that motion. Any further discussion? Okay. Hearing no further discussion, I will call for the vote. All in favor of the motion say aye. All opposed say nay.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carries. Complaint number 24-36 regarding Dr. Powers has been dismissed.
Hello, this is DB. I just was able to enter.
Okay. We just finished that case.
If I could, I'd like to make a few statements, if that's okay.
Mr. GB, this is Jean Galvin, the board's attorney. The matter has been adjudicated. They moved to dismiss the case. You did have a representative present, SB, your yes. wife, who is also your power of attorney. So she was yes. present in your stead. So the fact that now the matter has been dismissed, there's nothing further to discuss. You were represented through your power of attorney.
Okay.
The licensee and complainant will be notified in writing by board staff in the near future regarding the committee's decision to today. Now moving on to the next case.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I apologize for interrupting. If I would recommend that we go to case 4G for Dr. Lanzalota's complaint, as all parties are here, and due to the timing time constraints of one of the parties, I'd recommend it being reviewed now.
Sure. No problem. Okay, so the next complaint scheduled for review today is case number 24-38 against Mary Ann Lanzalota. I will provide the committee with a summary on this case as I am the lead. Okay, so this is the summary of complaint number 24-38 against Dr. Mary Ann Lanzalota, holder of license number 826. issued in 1979. Complainant JT is involved in a contentious court custody proceeding with his ex-wife. Court proceedings have been ongoing since 2004. In June 2021, the court appointed Dr. Lanzalota as a therapeutic interventionist to assist with the reunification process between father and his eldest daughter, who was 17 and a half years old at the time the appointment occurred. The order specified that Dr. Lanzalota shall supply brief 90-day intervention summaries and that the TI fees shall be paid 65% the father, 35% the mother. Dr. Lanzalota submitted one report to the court dated January 2022, approximately 6 months following her appointment, noting that no additional services will be provided as daughter had recently turned 18. Reunification was not successful. In his complaint, JT cites that Dr. Lanzalota allowed mother to wrongfully delay the process and failed to inform the court, failed to consider evidence confirming the mother's false accusations, and failed to inform the court, failed to comply with the order of appointment, failed to inform the court of mother's noncompliance, portrayed father in a negative light, failed to hold one meeting with his daughter, canceled at the last minute one meeting, and provided a false explanation for canceling the appointment. In summary, JT alleges that Dr. Lanzalota did not take any meaningful action to reunite them and failed to give this case the timely attention it required. JT noted that the court found that Dr. Lanzalota wrongfully and unfairly portrayed JT in an extremely negative light in her report, omitting pertinent information in her one and only report to the court. Dr. Lanzalota's position is that she met the standard of care, relied in good faith upon the information she provided, and did her best to assist with meeting father and daughter's relationship, with mending father and daughter's relationship despite the very late appointment by the court. Their relationship was already estranged at the time of Dr. Lanzalota's involvement. She noted that the previous interventionist had encouraged all participants to engage in meaningful individual therapy, but found that none of the parties had engaged in meaningful individual therapy. There is no evidence that her conduct was the cause of the failed reunification, not that she fell below the standard of care or committed any acts of unprofessional conduct. And this concludes my summary to the committee. Is complainant JT present? If so, please unmute yourself and state your initials only for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Present.
Go ahead.
I filed this formal, first of all, thank you for allowing me to speak. I appreciate that. I filed this formal complaint against Dr. Lanzalota, who was assigned as a therapeutic interventionist, in my case, due in part of her utter complete failure, extreme bias, neglect, deceit, ability to comply with the court's order as a therapeutic interventionist. The mental and financial anguish she has caused to me and my family is immeasurable. As you stated, I've been entangled in a custody battle for over 20 years. The court has assigned multiple court-appointed advisors, therapeutic interventionists, parenting coordinators, and totally were 9 different doctors that have been assigned to my case. Dr. Lanzalota is the only one I've ever filed a complaint against. Let me repeat that. She's the only one I ever filed a complaint against. Also, you stated that she said that I did not complete the individual counseling that was ordered by the therapeutic interventionist before her. That's also another lie by Dr. Lanzalota. I went to Dr. Robin Hall. I completed my 4 individual counseling classes that was ordered by the court. And that's how Dr. Lanzalota got assigned to this case. So that's lie number 2. Lie number 3 is Dr. Lanzalota is going to attempt to confuse this. I believe she's going to attempt to confuse this committee. And she's going to claim that the therapeutic intervention was based on an apology letter that had to be written by me. And when we deposed Dr. Lanzalota in our deposition, we asked her to produce that evidence. And here we are 2.5 years later. She has not produced any of that evidence. No parent should ever have to experience and endure what I have or what I am quite certain other families have had to endure. The emotional pain and the rest this has caused, coupled with the loss of the child, meaning my relationship with Gianna, is incomprehensible. For me, this is about protecting and maintaining relationships between parents and their children. Therefore, the family unit can remain intact and all who have a family can enjoy their respective roles. If Dr. Lancelotti is permitted to continue as a TI, this will ensure the complete opposite will happen, and this can emotionally and financially ruin families, individuals, and most important, children. In my view, there needs to be consequences to Dr. Lancelotti's bias, negligence, deception, and lack of regard for the family dynamic. Upon the request of my attorney, after 5 months, Dr. Lancelotti submitted a summary report to the court that attempted to deflect blame and mislead the court. Dr. Lancelotti's report had the undertone that the reason for the failed reunification was solely based on my lack of cooperation and canceled meetings, as opposed to where the blame squarely belongs, which was Dr. Lancelotti and my ex-wife. Dr. Lancelotti is a professional who many are embattled in the court system, place their trust and confidence in, and as a last attempt to restore, a salvage, or begin a relationship with their children. Dr. Lancelotti has no regard or empathy for the family. Rather, it appears the only issues Dr. Lancelotti is willing to address are non-payments and retainer fees. My ex-wife refused to pay Dr. Lancelotti. Shockingly, in Dr. Lancelotti's report, she would have the reader believe that it was me that didn't pay her, not the mother. It was me that canceled the appointments, not the mother. It was me that was difficult to schedule with, not the mother. It was me who scheduled the one and only meeting at the last minute on November 11, 2021, when it was Dr. Lancelotti who canceled the meeting. Dr. Lancelotti claimed my ex-wife was future-focused and positive. On September 13th, more than a year after the appointment, Dr. Lancelotti was deposed by my attorney, Norman Katz. During Dr. Lancelotti's deposition, she continued to lie, deflect, and place blame when she could. Unfortunately for Dr. Lancelotti, the email correspondence and evidence I had supplied to her told another story, the true and correct story. Then and only then, when Dr. Lancelotti realized she was being held accountable and the evidence was stacked against her, she turned and started to place blame on my ex-wife. She continued to attempt to deceive and place blame when she could against me. I was in complete shock that a medical professional could be so deceitful and unapologetic with absolutely no moral compass whatsoever. It was at that moment when I decided to file this complaint. It's one thing to make honest mistakes and do the best with what you have. It's another issue altogether when a medical therapist is in a position placed of trust and professional and has no ethics, is biased, negligent, deceitful, inflexible, obstinate, indignant, and is not held accountable. If Dr. Lancelotti engaged in the aforementioned complaints, filed a false report, lied to the court, and was biased against me, how many other cases has she been involved in where she conducted herself in the same manner without being held accountable? There are many, many, many instances where this happens. You can go on the website and look up what her her behavioral sciences are. Dr. Lancelotti didn't provide any of the indisputable facts which was supported by the evidence which would have come to light to the court. In closing, the purpose of this complaint is I am hopeful Dr. Lancelotti is removed entirely at all capacities from the family court system. I already lost one child. No parent should ever have to experience and endure what I have or what I'm quite certain other families have had to endure. The emotional pain and duress this has caused, coupled with the loss of a child, meaning my relationship with my daughter Gianna, is immeasurable. For me, this is about protecting and maintaining the relationship between the parents and their children. Therefore, the family unit can remain intact and all who have a family can enjoy their respective roles. If Dr. Lancelotti is permitted to continue as a TI, this will ensure the complete opposite will happen, and this can emotionally and financially ruin families and individuals. I thank you for bringing this to your attention, and I hope we have a fair and equitable solution.
Thank you for your statement. Dr. Lancelotti, are you and your attorney present? If so, you may unmute both yourselves and state your full names for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Madam Chair, this would actually be the opportunity for the committee to ask any questions of JT first.
I apologize. I did skip that. So are there any questions for JT? And I apologize about moving ahead. Are there any questions for JT before we, Dr. Lancelotti and her attorney speak?
I have none at this time, Madam Chair.
Okay. Okay. So since there are no questions, Dr. Lancelotti, are you and your attorney present? If so, you may unmute both yourselves and state your full names for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes, and the committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Yeah, I'm present. Dr. Lancelot is present. Thank you.
Chair Medina, members of the board, this is Flynn Carey, counsel for Dr. Lanzalata. I'm going to take the time to provide some brief statement. This is a case in which the court appointed a licensee for reunification when the minor child had approximately 6 months before she turned 18, and then the court lost jurisdiction. Regarding the very lengthy complaint filed by father here, it attempts to blame the state of the relationship between complainant and child on the licensee, and that her involvement somehow caused the rift. The reality is his father and child have been estranged for years. And as the complainant indicated, 9 doctors have looked at this case. Most recently, prior to Dr. Lanzalata, there was a clinician who said complainant preferred to blame mother for alienating children and did not appear to be willing to accept any other explanation for how his child became estranged. Complainant's abrasive behavior can make his children fearful of him. Previous evaluator, and I've never seen this before in a report, indicated that the relationship between parent and child was so broken that the therapeutic intervention should be adjusted to focus primarily on complainant's relationship with his younger daughter. And that all occurred long before licensee was involved in any way. Licensee was appointed about 2 years later. Unsurprisingly, the complainant's relationship with daughter had not improved, and there was very little time remaining. We gave you a very detailed timeline between the parties and the licensee. And despite father sometimes being quicker to respond than mother, complainant was essentially resistant to some of the ways in which licensee suggested he approach daughter. Licensee did indicate that both parents needed to write letters of apology and reflection. Father refused to call it an apology letter, and true to his prior behaviors, and as he demonstrated today, is very focused on blaming other people. Something that has continued in his legal battle with mother. Reinforcing his resistance to take any accountability, complainant insisted he had, quote, in his complaint, nothing to apologize for. And he also then attempted to adopt a lot of Dr. Childress from California's parental alienation bullet points, further hardening his position on whether or not he feels like he shares any of the blame for years long of estrangement. In 2023, 2 years after Dr. Lanzalata was involved, the court really made findings about mother's conduct. And that's what spurred complainant into now filing a complaint against licensee. But this is where the complainant gets confused. His position is that because mother provided incorrect information or delayed steps in reunification, that must be imputed now onto mother. Onto Dr. Lanzalata. He complains that the licensee did not hold mother accountable. The reality is that's not her job. Her job is to attempt to reunify and put things in place. And this is where things get missed. All three of them are part of this reunification. And as much as the complainant wants to shove through a reunification, there is a daughter involved as well. And that daughter had previous encounters with father. It's documented in the previous reports where she was so upset by the encounter that they had to stop and the intern had to pull the complainant aside and tell the complainant that he may have irreparably harmed the relationship, might have damaged the relationship beyond repair. So yes, the complainant may not have been happy with how the process went, but there's two other people involved, mother and the child. Regarding the fact that it didn't move fast enough, it moved at the pace that licensee used her clinical judgment to believe that it was appropriate. And when there are three different people involved, she has to balance the mental state of all three of those people. It would do no benefit to any of them if she forced through an encounter that resulted in the young lady becoming dysregulated or even further estranged from her father. There's a complaint that licensee didn't weigh mother's conduct heavily enough. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but it's not the licensee's job to adjudicate who did what to who. She is there to receive the information and determine going forward what type of things can be put in place to allow for reunification on this very quick timeline. There was an attack on licensee's experience. There was also this misleading statement in which the complainant claims that licensee said she had no experience in reunification. The reality is it is extremely rare that that someone at 17 and a half is party to a reunification process. It's very rare that happened. And what she testified to was in her experience, her 50 years of experience, she's only had reunification with people this close to the age of majority a few times. But she has had years and years of reunification experience, and we provided you a catalog of her continuing education. I think at the end of the day, the complainant is not happy that reunification didn't occur. I think on the record before you, that should not have come as a surprise. I think even in the best circumstances, with everyone on their best behavior and everything aligning, there is not a situation in which these parties would have necessarily been able to reunify that quickly. And I think that a lot of the time what we see is complainants' unrealistic expectations. And I think it is really, you know, really crystallized in the encounter in which he insisted that he was going to be having lunch with his daughter as the first reunification meeting, when that was never contemplated. That was something that may have happened in the future, but really what was going to happen is the reading of the non-apology letter, followed by potentially some future encounter with the young lady. So in closing, a licensee met the standard of care here in a very difficult case with very difficult entrenched participants on a very short timeline. It's unfortunate the mother engaged in apparent misconduct with the court, but there is no evidence that the licensee engaged in misconduct. And this is a case where we're asking you to find no acts of unprofessional conduct and asking that you dismiss.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Lanzalota or her attorney? Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Dr. Lanzalota. What was the daughter's age at the time that you were appointed by the court?
Approximately 17 and a half.
Okay. In your experience, someone that close to the age of a majority of 18, what's the likelihood that a court order for reunification, that the process of reunification would actually take place at such a late age? Just in your experience.
Sometimes you can at least bring the child and the parent to the point where, you know, the child is amenable to having a lunch or a coffee with the parent, which is what, you know, I would have liked to achieved. Mm-hmm. But as far as a real reunification of returning to a parenting time schedule, that doesn't usually happen with children of this age.
Thank you. And maybe a question for Mr. Carey. Since the contentious nature of reunification orders by family courts, am I correct in saying that this is no longer an option to have a court-appointed therapeutic interventionist for reunification of alienated parents and children?
Chair Medina, Dr. Stewart, this is a situation in which once a child ages out of the family court, the family court loses jurisdiction over that child for everything other than there's some back child support and some financial issues that you can still recover. But yeah, the whole driving force on this case, unfortunately, is that once a child turns 18, the court doesn't have jurisdiction. That person's in the majority. So what happened here is the court appointed her with a very limited amount of time available for reunification.
Okay, thank you.
Am I allowed to respond to this?
I was wondering if you knew whether that continues to be a process where the family court orders reunification therapy. I was under the impression that in Arizona that has become a thing of the past and it's no longer attempted.
It's in flux, Dr. Stewart, and I by no means am a family law expert. I do believe that what has happened is there are some things that are called forced reunification or reunification camps. things like that, that have been really highly problematic because what they have done, and again, this is a little bit more policy driven, but there's been some concerns that taking a child, and I'm talking more like a preteen, young child, forcing them to be placed with another parent for reunification, kind of a forced reunification, that is not permitted anymore. So there was a statute passed recently. The concept of reunification is it's an outgrowth of therapeutic intervention. So you have TIs, reunification, all sorts of different ways in which an expert can be appointed by the court to assist in any sort of limited way. And so that's all still fair game. The place that's fallen out of favor is this sort of idea of forced reunification or reunification when the other parent is problematic. So for instance, if they've committed child abuse, crimes, things like that. So it's evolving, but there are some restrictions. But right now, this type of reunification of ordering the parties to engage with each other, I believe is still permitted.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carey. I appreciate that. I have no further questions.
Carey. Thank you, Dr. Stewart. I do have some questions. To me, the result is a separate issue of the report contained. But to me, I'm more interested in the process itself because, and this question is for Dr. Lancelota, you get a case that you know in 6 months it's going to be out of your hands because the child turns the age of majority. And you have a parent, in this case, the mother, that takes a month to get back to you the questionnaire or whatever, you know, documentation she had to get to you. I mean, is that typical to wait that long when you know the clock is ticking? Would you not give X number of days to get the questionnaire, you know, to get them engaged back?
Well, that's a good question. And there are delays sometimes in these cases getting paperwork returned. And I did appreciate the fact that the child was going to reach the age of majority in December of that year. But I felt like we did get on board after that and were working and progressing, in my opinion, at that time, in a way that could have made that possible.
At any point in that month that she took time to get back to you? I mean, remind her, we need to get this going, anything along those lines?
I believe I did, yes.
Okay. My next question is, why did you not submit a report at the 90-day mark if there was required to submit a report at the 90-day mark? To me, it would be okay to say, you know, ask the mother to respond on this date. Mother responded 4 weeks later. This appointment was set up. Just a factual update. Why was that 90-day report not submitted?
For a couple of reasons. I think that at that point, the report wasn't submitted because the case I thought was progressing. And for me to write a report is... does cause the parties to have to pay additional fees for that report. So at that point in time, I did not write a report.
Okay. Wouldn't that be known by both parties when they engage in this process?
I'm sorry, would what be known?
Wouldn't that be known to both parties that at 90 days you would need to write a report and it's part of the cost of your services?
It would have been known, yes, that they would have to pay for those services.
Okay.
But in my opinion, at that point, I thought we were progressing in the right direction and writing a report didn't seem like something that was going to help or hurt the situation in any way.
Well, I'm just thinking if I'm assigned by a court to do something, I would want them to know either way. Yes, it's moving along. There has been some progress, or no, it is stalled. I'm not getting engagement from one of the parties. I think that knowing one way or the other would be important for the court. Are there any other questions for Dr. Lanzalota or her attorney? So the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. I will begin the deliberation since I am the lead on this case, unless any other committee member wishes to start the discussion. I would like to make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you. My apologies. I was looking at something. Okay. So we will, we are back. So we will then continue with, start with deliberations. In this case, and just to remind everybody, please know that deliberation is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. I will begin the deliberation since I am the lead on this case, unless any other committee member wishes to start the discussion. I believe, you know, regardless of the outcome of the case, which has been, you know, in court, and the reunification or lack thereof, there are things that were concerning to me. And this particular case, I think that a failure to do a report within, you know, when instructed by the court, regardless of where that report would go, positive or negative, is concerning. You know, as a psychologist, we have a duty to those who have been appointed, to us in our care. And to me, this is not different. And you cannot take your psychologist hat and say, well, I'm wearing another hat, and decide, you know, that it's not your responsibility to comply with court orders. Aside of, you know, some other things that, in my opinion, again, were concerning. Any other comments or discussions from the members?
Madam Chair.
Yes, sorry.
In looking back through the ethical codes and violations that are possible, I guess O might be the only category that could be considered, but I still am not seeing enough to justify some determination of misconduct in terms of doing forensic practice, in addition to the 90-day report not being made to the court, I'm not seeing anything else of consequence. And if that is the only issue, I guess I'm not seeing it rise to a sufficient level to refer to the full board. Thank you. That's all of my
comments. Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Yes, Mr. Wynn.
Although I respect Dr. Stewart's opinion on this, I kind of lean more towards you, Dr. Medina, on You know, these are not filing that, not being timely in this way, is some level of unprofessional or negligent conduct. So I kind of lean in more towards where you're at on this, I think, or at least where I think you're at on this.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. I also, you know, lots of times when in between sort of appointments and things, and this was a case that, of course, was pressed for time, regardless of the outcome, you know, the reality is that, you know, complainant and daughter have been estranged for years, and I don't know how likely it would have been, you know, that the outcome would have been different, but I am looking at, you know, sort of the facts of the case and then what was also found in the, I guess, deposition when she was asked more in depth about the case. Mr. Wynn, do you have? Yes.
Yeah, I think it to be more clear about my position here, I think sometimes these things are good to send to the full board for consideration, for, you know, the purpose of having more people weigh in on this, and that'd be where I would lean on it.
Yes, and I want to remind everybody that at this point, our choices are to dismiss or to move on for full board consideration. It is not to make a final decision on a case. Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm swayed by that rationale and by Mr. Wynn's comments. And I, too, believe it would be helpful for the full board to weigh in, especially in terms of the type of complaint that this is. It may be very useful for the entire board to view it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any other comments before we entertain a motion? Okay. So I will make a motion. I move that complaint number 24-38 be referred to the full board for review of a possible violation of ARS 32-2061, A16, Section O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe, or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice.
Second.
Okay. All in favor say aye. Well, any aye. Further discussion? Sorry. Any further discussion? Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
No one opposed. So the motion carries. Complaint number 24-38 against Dr. Lancelota has been referred to the full board for review. The licensee and complainant will be notified in writing by board in the near future regarding the committee's decision today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Welcome. Moving on to the next case. So, Ms. Michelson, do we then go back to 4B to resume the order?
Yes, Madam Chair. Unless the committee needs a comfort break, they can certainly take one. It's their decision.
Let's see. Any... No preferences? Okay, let's move forward. I want to use Dr. Wynn, Mr. Wynn, as long as he's here. So the next complaint scheduled for review today is case number 24-37 against Heather Nash. Dr. Stewart, would you please provide a brief overview of this complaint since you are the lead?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd be happy to. Heather Nash, PhD, received her doctorate from the Idaho State University in 2001. She holds a license in Arizona beginning in 2006 to the current date. The complainant is CS. The type of complaint is that Dr. Nash issued a report ordered by the Social Security Administration, SSA, on the complainant, CS, and that the complainant holds that Dr. Nash failed to consider or include information from past medical providers and that Dr. Nash was unprofessional during the evaluations. The complaint is that the complainant has various diagnostic illnesses, mental illnesses that were not substantiated by Dr. Nash in her report, and that Dr. Nash, as a diagnostic impression, was to rule out a specific diagnosis and said that another diagnostic category was mild. The complainant asks that the Board of Examiners have Dr. Nash's report permanently removed from the Social Security Administration case file and to be removed from any future consideration concerning her appeal. Dr. Nash issued a response to this that she could not provide us a report of the complainant. But fortunately, the complainant did include, as a part of her documents submitted to the board, a copy of Dr. Nash's 2023 report. Dr. Nash indicates that the records that she received to review were provided to her by the Social Security Administration, and that she does not have the capacity to order additional records be forwarded to her. That she, in her review, that she reviews the records and has a face-to-face interview with the individual, and that that's the basis of her report and her impressions. Dr. Nash further indicates that, quote, I do not make decisions about determination of disability for claimants, close quotes. And that's the end of my review.
I'm muted. Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Is complainant CS present? If so, please unmute yourself and state your initials only for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Hi, yes, good morning, CS. I'm here today. Good morning. I'm here to bring to your attention a mental health evaluation done on 7/28/23 by Dr. Heather Nash. This 8-page evaluation is a fallacious attempt to dismiss verifiable medical records submitted to Social Security for my disability benefits and to ignore years of documented treatment for all my mental and physical diagnosis. My benefits were denied the same day her report was submitted to Social Security. I was shamed, berated, and insulted throughout this 8-page evaluation by Dr. Nash. Throughout this evaluation, she attempts to minimize my symptoms by using negative comments, adding words I never said, false statements, and unrelated examples. I'm devastated by the numerous unfounded bias attacks on my character. I was previously deemed disabled and receiving SSI benefits from 2001 to 2021. I have a doctor's note restricting my work hours to 4 hours a day, 20 hours a week. I have years of documents showing I've been actively participating in therapy, treatment, and trying different medications. And I've been granted several reasonable accommodations for past jobs and housing. Yet she writes, I have no difficulty and no limitations. Her description of my social life, doctor's name, work history, third degree burn, physical limitations, sleep patterns, and my daily activities have also been documented inaccurately. It is unclear why she wrote so many false and insulting statements about me. She uses my past drug use and criminal history as examples, but conveniently leaves out the dates. It's been 20 years since my last arrest, and I've been involved in the recovery community for 19 years. I attend weekly AA meetings, yet she writes, I go to clubs and social events and hangs out with my friends. She attempts to discredit my statements numerous times. She mentions my past drug use 4 times throughout this evaluation. As you can see by my submitted documents and evidence, she clearly leaves out true and vital information and only references one part of a medical record from January of 23, but dismisses everything else in that record that has been verified. She uses statements and examples in a context that is misleading and false. She says I was genuinely laughing. This is false. I slightly laugh when I'm nervous or uncomfortable. Throughout this evaluation, she uses unrelated examples to make my statement seem false or untrue. Her evaluation was based on a 50-minute one-time visit. I observed her being very dismissive, callous, and withdrawn. She rarely made eye contact with me and sat behind her laptop the whole entire time. Her unprofessional misconduct and gross negligence has caused me months of severe distress ever since I read this false evaluation on April 15th, 2024. Her senseless invalidation of my symptoms and repeated false statements have made me feel worthless, insecure, and has shattered what little self-esteem I've been able to muster up throughout the years. I am devastated and in disbelief. She's supposed to be a mental health professional, yet she writes I exaggerated my symptoms and that my statements are to be interpreted with caution. She degraded, insulted, and berated me. She wrote false statements, inaccurate examples, and tried to minimize my symptoms numerous times. This is not an honest evaluation according to the psychologist's code of conduct. She swore this evaluation to be true and accurate, yet I've pointed out numerous inaccuracies and false statements, and I've submitted documents of evidence that proves this was done intentionally and maliciously. My records were available to her. This evaluation is false, unfounded, and biased based on her misconceptions. I'm severely offended by this 8-page false evaluation, and it has caused me months of severe distress, anguish, and emotional pain. I please ask that you hold Dr. Nash responsible. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, CS, and thank you for being here. Committee members, are there any questions for CS? Hearing none. Dr. Nash, are you and your attorney present? If so, you may unmute both yourselves and say your full names for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Medina. This is Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee. I'll let her go ahead and introduce herself directly, and I know she has a few comments she'd like to offer to the committee this morning.
Good morning. My name is Heather Nash, and I would like to offer a few comments to the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to meet with you and to provide an opening statement. As Dr. Stewart noted, I have been licensed in the state of Arizona since 2006, and I began providing psychological consultative examinations for Social Security Disability Administration in 2006 as well. Because SSDA owns the record, I'm not freely able to provide specific information, but I'd like to provide some general facts about how I normally do evaluations for SSDA. They are extremely different from any other kind of assessment that I've ever done in my career. And they are designed to answer specific questions that SSDA has asked an examiner to assess, in this case me, which gives them additional information about work-related limitations. Their evaluations are not exhaustive in nature, and they're typically solely for the use of SSDA at their discretion. At the beginning of an evaluation, I verbally review my credentials, my relationship with SSDA, the nature and purpose of the evaluation, the notion that SSDA owns the record and therefore is responsible for release of records to interested parties, and that anything a claimant says or does may be entered into my report and used to determine disability by SSDA. These evaluations are requested electronically and include medical and or mental health treatment records in the electronic communication. I only have access to those records included for me to review, and I have no way of knowing whether other relevant treatment records exist or whether they've been provided to SSDA. I include a written summary of any and all mental health treatment records and any and all relevant medical records in my report that have been available to me. Evaluators such as myself rely heavily on such records for corroboration of claimant reports of symptoms, history, or diagnosis, given the nature of the evaluation and our limited time with claimants. It has been my experience that relevant records may not be included in the information provided to me by SSDA. But again, I have no way of knowing of their existence, and I'm not allowed to receive such records directly from claimants. When a claimant comes, I am typing as they are speaking, and so my eye contact is limited, which is really different from when a client comes into my office to do counseling, or even if I'm doing a different kind of assessment. We're really time limited, and so I want to make sure that I do due diligence in collecting information that they want to provide to me. I do my best to represent and utilize the available information, including reports that they make, that claimants would make, available records, observations that I make during the assessment, claimant statements that I include in quotes, performance on any requested assessments, and or information from relevant third parties, such as in the case of a kid, parents or guardians might give me information. And I use that information to respond to SSDA questions about the claimant, which includes a diagnostic impression. I attempt to interpret available information consistent with my community standards. I want to restate, I'm not directly involved in the determination of whether or not a claimant is ultimately is awarded disability by SSDA, and I have no knowledge for the mass majority of cases after I've submitted my report what actually happened, what kind of determination happened. It is my understanding also that claimants have multiple avenues of recourse available to them after the initial evaluation with psychological examiner if they do not agree with SSDA's decision regarding the determination of disability status. Thank you for your time, and I am requesting that the complaint is dismissed.
Thank you, Dr. Nash. Are there any questions for Dr. Nash or her attorney? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. I know you cannot comment specifically on the report nor give information about the report, Dr. Nash, as the records belong to SSA and not to you. But generally speaking, if you're writing a diagnostic opinion and you include R/O, which is standard for rule out, and then there's a specific diagnosis following that, does that mean you're not diagnosing that condition, or that further inquiry needs to be made in order to substantiate that diagnosis?
I think. Excuse me, Dr. Thor, I'm sorry.
Need to interrupt just for a minute, just because I need to run. I'm sorry. I had to leave right about 9:50. So apologies, but good luck, y'all.
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nguyen.
Yes. So if I don't have enough information to diagnose a particular diagnosis that a claimant has alleged, but I believe additional information is required to make such a diagnosis. I will typically give a provisional diagnosis that's related and also state that I would like to rule out that I would like, there are psychologists who work for disability, for SSDA, and their job is to interpret all of the information that they have, including maybe past records from other evaluations or other sorts of information, and to add my report to the mix. And so I don't ever know what they have. I would, I might put something in as a rule out in order for them to signal to them that additional information is needed to determine whether or not a claimant meets criteria for that diagnosis.
Thank you for that answer, Dr. Nash. Additionally, in your reports in general, if you make a statement that records were provided for review, and then you would cite those records, does that mean that you have considered those records?
Yes, thank you. That's a good question. Two things about that. Yes, it means that I would have considered those records, A, and B, it would mean that that is the total of some of medical or mental health treatment records that I received. I have changed my wording on that to just be clearer that that's all that I have received.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. If I may continue. So in your records, in your reports in general, if you say that the patient or the claimant has reported, and then you list specific illnesses and diagnostic conditions, then is that your way of saying that the claimant has presented that information to you, and that that information has been considered by you?
Yes, thank you. If I list a diagnosis, it means one of two things.
When you say quote unquote the claimant reported.
Okay, thank you. Yes. So either
diagnostic category.
Right. So either they said that diagnosis in the course of the interview, or they had previously reported to disability that they had that diagnosis, and disability has asked me to evaluate that particular area of function.
Okay, thank you. When in your reports, when you describe specific categories that DDA, the SSA wants responses to, and one of those is thought content, and one may be affect. So under affect, if you included things under there, then that those are things that you have actually observed of the client, whether it looks like kind of neutral, not agreeing with nor denying, but that these are things of observation. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I have no further questions at this point.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Okay. So the committee will now begin deliberation. Please know that deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. Dr. Stewart, would you please begin deliberation since you are the lead?
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Yes, I'd be happy to. The claimant is certainly powerful in her presentation, in the complaint process, and then also in her presentation this morning. And the complaints are that specific diagnostic information was not considered by Dr. Nash, and that the second thing is Dr. Nash was unprofessional and rude and almost castigating during the interview process. As I read the responses, and including the report submitted by the complainant, CS, which included the SSA report, I'm not seeing any inappropriate or unknown. It seems like that Dr. Nash did consider previous diagnoses. She cited it in the report. And that also, I think when someone is typing on a laptop or an iPad during an evaluation, that's a whole different animal than doing psychotherapy, where eye contact and affect is important to be with the individual. And that is a common standard in conducting either SSA evaluations or court evaluations of the like. I'm not seeing anything that rises to a level of unprofessional conduct. Additionally, in terms of the request of the claimant that this board remove a document from the Social Security Administration's records is you know, out of our judicial purview altogether. So I'm not seeing anything of substance in the complaint that for unprofessional conduct.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Stewart. I agree with you. There are things that are definitely not within our control or purview in regards to, you know, the evaluation or removing documents. I mean, I concur with your assessment of the case. I did not see anything that, I mean, given, you know, the records that Dr. Nash received, right, and not knowing exactly those, but it doesn't sound like there's anything that could be construed as unprofessional conduct in this particular case. So,
if the chair would entertain a motion, I move that the case be dismissed.
Second. Okay. So I will call for a vote. All in favor of the motion to dismiss the case, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Complaint number 24-37 regarding Dr. Nash has been dismissed.
Thank you, committee members.
You're welcome. The licensee and complainant will be notified in writing by board staff in the near future regarding the committee's decision today. And it is 9:57. We will take a 10-minute comfort break and return at 10:10 to review the one case that we have left. Thank you. Ms. Michelson, do you need to call roll again? No. Okay, I'll wait.
Just need to verify that Dr. Stewart is back.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Dr. Stewart is back and Mr. Nguyen has left the meeting. So, okay. So let's get started. It is 10:10. So the next complaint scheduled for review today is case number 2443 against Jonna Dunlap. I will provide the committee with a summary of this case as I am the lead. So this is a summary for complaint number 2443 against Dr. Jonna Dunlap, holder of license number 3834, issued in 2006. In June 2024, I apologize. The board received a complaint from DR against Dr. Dunlap, Auntie L, who was listed on the website as a psychologist, on the website for the agency as a psychologist, but TL is not licensed as a psychologist, so it is out of the purview of this board. DR son was evaluated by Dr. Dunlap was referred to Dr. Dunlap for an evaluation, and I am refraining from stating the diagnosis that the evaluation was for. DR alleges that she received a call to go over her son's evaluation from TL. TL did not conduct the evaluation. TL stated that DR son could not meet criteria for the diagnosis as his IQ was too high and the need for parenting training. TL also made remarks about possible contributing factors to the son's behavior, being raised by a single mother and lacking a father figure or strong male role model. DR was very distressed during the call as she has been trying to get help for her son's needs. DR shared that she does not want a diagnosis that isn't warranted, but wants her son to be treated fairly and not evaluated by these antiquated views. In her response, Dr. Dunlap explained that she has worked for the agency since 2019, that her client is the agency, not the patient or person being evaluated, that the evaluation reports that Dr. Dunlap conducts at the agency are consultative exams for referring providers. At the top of each report, there is a statement indicating results are not directly reviewed with an evaluee because the reports are consultative to the referring provider. As a result of this complaint, Dr. Dunlap personally debriefs the parents or evaluees regarding the results of evaluation that she conducts at the agency. The son's, DR son's evaluation was based on a referral from La Frontera, another agency in town. According to Dr. Dunlap's findings, son did not meet the full diagnostic criteria for the referral diagnosis, but he was at risk due to family history. It appears that the R is not questioning the diagnostic conclusions contained in Dr. Dunlap's report, and TL is contracted by the agency, not by Dr. Dunlap. And that concludes my summary to the board. Is DR, complainant DR, is DR present? Okay, it doesn't look like it. Okay. Dr. Dunlap, are you and your attorney present? If so, you may unmute both yourselves and state your full names for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. This is Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee. She can certainly go ahead and introduce herself, and we're available to answer any questions you may have. But I think that the response to the complaint that we've offered to the board adequately states our position.
Good morning. My name is Jonna Dunlap. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. As indicated in my response and in your summary, I do provide consultative exams for the agency, and those are for their referring providers. The basis of the complaint is TL's review of those results with DR. I was unaware that that review had occurred until I received the board notice. And since then, I have directed the agency to only have reviews done by myself if they are coordinated by the agency outside of the referring provider. Also, as a result of the incident, through legal counsel, I had determined that I now require my personal informed consent to be utilized by the agency for any evaluees assigned to me. While I've always verbally reviewed the evaluation process with the evaluees during intake, I do now require that to be an additional form involved in any evaluee assigned to me. So again, thank you for the opportunity to address the board. I look forward to any questions.
Okay, so committee members, well, are there any questions for Dr. Dunlap or her attorney? Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, for Dr. Dunlap. So you were a contract employee of the agency for which you did an examination of the minor child for the complainant. Is that correct?
Correct.
In your, I guess now, because of this complaint, you personally review and debrief the parent involved with what your findings are in your report. Is that correct?
Correct.
Do you have any direct control of the hiring practices of the clinic?
I do not. I'm a contracted provider with them, as all the other psychologists are contracted as well. We're not direct hires.
Were you aware that the clinic website lists Dr. T.L. Saidi as being a psychologist?
I was not aware until the board notice.
I have no further questions at this point, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. I do have a few questions. So before this complaint, Dr. Dunlap, did you ever discuss evaluation results with clients, with people you had evaluated? I understand your client is the agency.
Sure. In instances where there were questions that the clients had that were forwarded to me, I would discuss those results more frequently. I would be contacted by the referring providers for clarification.
Okay. And are you aware of why they would have TL discuss your evaluation if TL did not complete the evaluation?
So my understanding, again, after the complaint, is that Psychological Pathways used TL and other individuals that had were considered postdocs in their agency to review results when there were questions. And as, again, more of a courtesy.
Oh, okay. Okay. And so did you follow up with DR after you heard how the interaction with TL?
I did not, only because I wasn't notified until the board complaint.
Okay. I have no further questions at this time.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you. Dr. Dunlap, in your evaluation of the minor child for a specific diagnosis of record, were you aware that previous evaluators had identified the specific diagnosis in question?
No, the only referral record I had was from the referring agency indicating that he had a prior diagnosis outside of the referral question.
I understand in reading your resume and professional vitae that you have organized in the Chandler School District their specific diagnostic program for the diagnosis in question. Is that correct?
Correct.
Would you consider yourself an expert in providing diagnostic services for such a specific diagnosis?
I would consider myself widely experienced in the field of providing that diagnosis.
Without going into specifics, how, as I recall, the complaint in your response that you did not find enough categorized specific sets of criteria to provide a specific diagnosis in question, but that you issued a word of caution that the child might be at risk for such. Is that correct?
Correct. Due to the family history, he has a sibling that was diagnosed.
Okay. I have no further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Okay. Since there are no further questions, the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. I will begin the deliberation since I am the lead on this case, unless any other committee member wishes to start the discussion. You know, in my opinion, and from the materials that I have, I didn't see anything in the evaluation per se, or, you know, the process, let's say, of Dr. Dunlap, what Dr. Dunlap was doing. I do have concerns about other people doing, discussing results when they were not involved in the evaluation whatsoever. I do have concerns about people being listed as psychologists who are not psychologists. And, but those don't fall within sort of the purview of the complaint per se against Dr. Dunlap. I don't see anything that raises to a level of unprofessional conduct or anything like that. I do hope that maybe something that comes out of this is that, you know, paying closer attention to the processes that agencies have. I am concerned that it seems that the owners of this agency are not psychologists or folks involved in the mental health or assessment field. Dr. Stewart, do you have any?
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Medina. I absolutely concur. I do not see that Dr. Dunlap directed TL, an unlicensed person, to, you know, debrief the child's mother in this case, that was done under the agency guidelines that Dr. Dunlap has no control over. Dr. Dunlap, being a contract employee, has no control over what the agency's policies are. I'm very pleased, however, that Dr. Dunlap has made the professional decision to debrief persons involved in her evaluations outside or parallel to agency guidelines. But I'm not seeing anything that rises to unprofessional practices by Dr. Dunlap.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Stewart. I agree. So
make a motion, Madam Chair.
Sure.
I move that the case be dismissed.
Second. Any hearing no further discussion. All in favor of the motion proposed by Dr. Stewart and second by me, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say nay. So motion carries. Complaint number 24-43 against Dr. Dunlap has been dismissed.
Thank you, committee members.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Dr. Dunlap. Okay. It seems that we have reached the end of our meeting. So as there is no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 10:26 a.m.
Thank you, Dr. Medina.